As we begin our study tonight, take the opportunity to welcome all of our visitors. We'll be studying from the book of Proverbs. Proverbs itself does not lend itself to a storyline. It's more a sequence of topics. So as opposed to providing a narrative that tells a story, we are looking at it topically. And Sunday morning we started a two-part session on the tongue. Sunday morning's session was based upon the idea of the tongue and its negative uses, sins of the tongue, so to speak. Tonight we'll be focused on the positive uses of the tongue and ways that the tongue can be used in a positive manner. We've also set this in the tone of a light of some of our previous studies. We had a gospel meeting on a topic called Crucial Conversations, with a focus on helping us to understand how to carry on conversation in a way that is edifying to one another, that we can identify the turns in conversation so that we're more effective in how we speak to people, how we treat people. And that in and of itself is an important aspect when we are teaching. It's an important aspect when we're listening. And we made the point that on Sunday morning that there are two parts to the utilization of the tongue. There's both the spoken part, which is you saying something, and there's the hearing part and how you hear it and listen to it and apply it. So those are some key aspects of that. So we get into our lesson today. One key thing is that messages can be perceived in different ways. How can the same message provoke opposite responses? And we made the point that it has to go to the heart of the speaker and the tone and the manner in which that message is being relayed, and also the heart of the hearer and how they are willing to hear the message and apply it to themselves. What two examples did we point to in our study on Sunday morning to draw this comparison? Stephen's defense. How did the people respond to Stephen's message? What did Stephen talk to them about? Christ crucified, did he not? And how that he came, he died, and was raised. And unfortunately, the Jews themselves had been the ones that had crucified him. Did they receive the message positively? No, they stoned him to death. Contrast that to the heart of the hearers on the day of Pentecost when Peter delivered his message. What did they say in Acts 2:37? What shall we do? And their hearts were completely different in that manner. Some of the same type of people, Jews, listening in the audience, responding in a totally different way. Was the message the same? It was. It was the same message. Peter talked to them about how the prophecies had been foretold and how that Christ was crucified and they had been responsible for killing him. Okay, it goes to the heart of the speaker and the heart of the hearer. And we realize that from a common sense standpoint. When we go to talk to somebody, we can deliver it in the sweetest and best way that can be applied. And if they're not willing, if someone's not willing to listen to it, or if someone is bent on receiving it in an ill way, is that conversation going to go well? No. But we can only do our part. Okay, if the heart of the speaker is right, he will guard his mouth. Okay? It's one of the points that we're going to make in Proverbs 13, 2 through 3. It says, whoever guards his mouth preserves his life. He who opens wide his lips come to ruin. Now, one of our earlier studies, we talked about Proverbs and the many references to the fool. What was one of the comments that's made about a fool? He runs his mouth too much, does he not? And just lets things just flow out. We made the comparison there on Sunday morning about one of the sins of the problem is talking too much and just letting the mind just completely open and just pouring out everything. Proverbs 15 and 1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but harsh words stir up anger. That's kind of obvious. And one of the points we made in our very introduction to Proverbs, this is a good example of contrast. This is a proverb that's based on a contrast of two different types, a soft answer versus harsh words. if a child needs consoling about something, do you start yelling at them? No. If a brother or sister is in trouble and they need encouragement, do you deliver the message using soft words or harsh words? Generally, you want to begin it in a way that it's soft words. Now, certain conversations may have to get down to brass tacks. Ultimately, if someone's in sin, you have to tell them that. But you do it in a way that is, as we mentioned it before, with a common purpose that their soul is at jeopardy. Colossians 4 and 6 makes the point, let your speech, and this is not in the book of Proverbs, obviously, but same type of message, let your speech be always gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. What does salt do for food? Preserves it, seasons it, gives it a little bit better taste, does it not? And it kind of depends on your preferences. Some people like salt, some people don't. But in general, sometimes if you need a little flavoring on your food, you add a little salt to it. If we want to add a little flavoring to our speech, sometimes we have to apply in a way, not from a flattery standpoint, but in a tone and in a choice of words that are most effectively received. If we look at our short list, and I'm going to bring this up again because I think it's pertinent to our study on the tongue. A crucial conversation is defined by three things. Its stakes are high, opinions vary, and emotions run high. And I think we asked on Sunday morning if anybody in the audience had had a crucial conversation, and would these apply, and we've all nodded. Yes, we have. Things get heated at times. Emotions run high when a conversation, you know, we say it's a spirited exchange. But when we look at a situation where we're working with someone that's not a Christian, stakes are high because the soul is at jeopardy. Or a brother's in sin, stakes are high because the soul is at jeopardy. Handling options and how we handle a conversation. We can avoid it. Can we not? Is that going to change anything if we avoid it? No. Okay? We can handle it badly. Or we can handle it well. Which of the three should we choose? The third one. Okay. Crucial conversations require a belief in a principle. Belief God can transform and make change. And belief that change can occur. If you don't believe anything's going to change in a conversation, will you actually attempt to carry it out? And we made the point on Sunday morning that no. If we don't believe that anything's going to happen, we're more than likely not even going to initiate a discussion on it. The fool's choice is speak up and it goes bad, or keep quiet and let it happen. Neither of those is acceptable. We seek to foster dialogue so thoughts, opinions, and feelings can be shared, generate a better understanding and buy-in. Dialogue is hindered by silence and violence, and we talked about those, is that when a conversation and communication with the tongue, when somebody checks out of a conversation, what do we say they've done? They've gone silent. If somebody's in your face yelling at you, or they've gone violent. Or if they're bullying their way around in the conversation to get their way, that's defined as having reverted to violence. We have to start with our hearts and what we want for ourselves, the other person, and our relationship. Okay, now as we continue our study as it relates to the tongue, we want to tie these principles together. So we'll continue to pull on that, and we'll use some examples as we go further at the end of our study. Time permitting. To calm anger, Proverbs talks about techniques for doing it. First one being Proverbs 15:1, a soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. I think in our political environment today, we can easily see when somebody throws cordwood on a fire, it flares up. Most notably, Twitter is used left and right to stir up one-liners and create angst and create problems. Oftentimes not a soft answer, but a grievous word. Proverbs 12 and 18, the tongue of the wise promotes health. Doesn't go on to say exactly how that health is promoted, but we can look at the characteristics of the wise, and we talked about that before. What's the theme of the book of Proverbs? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Okay. The key there is that the wise is going to obey the commands of God. He's going to look to the word and going to apply that. So as the wise person promotes health, it'll be in the context of God's word. Proverbs 25 and 11, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in a setting of silver. Okay, well now this is a very stark contrast, is it not? Words are not physical like a piece of gold. But if we equate them on a different scale, on a scale of value, can words have value? They can have tremendous value. Our nation preserves a document called the Declaration of Independence because people value the words that were written in that declaration. We preserve and continue to study God's word because it has value. A word fitly spoken has value. What can a word fitly spoken do? A softly spoken word, okay. It can encourage. It can show love. We exchange cards on Valentine's Day to express love. Okay? We exchange cards or sentiments at different times to encourage other people. We send thank you notes. We send, you know, get well cards. A word fitly spoken has value. And it shows an interest in the people that we're communicating with. We made the point as well, by comparison, that the pen is mightier than a sword. Now, the tongue is different from the pen, but it's the written word. It's communication in its form. Written communication is extremely valuable if we look at it on a scale of value. And that's the point that's being made here by the writer, is that properly delivered communication and speech and word, whatever form it takes, whether verbal, written, nonverbal, has great value. Bad example is 2 Samuel 19:41-43. I'm going to have to turn to that because this is a passage that's a bit longer than I would have on the screen. 2 Samuel 19. The context here is that David is returning to Jerusalem after the rebellion, and his people are coming back in. He's coming across the Jordan, and starting in verse 41, "And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said unto the king, Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away, and have brought the king and his household and all the king's men with him over Jordan? And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, Because the king is a near kin to us. Wherefore then be ye angry for this matter? Have ye eaten at all of the king's, have we eaten at all of the king's cost? Or hath he given us any gift? And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, We have 10 parts in the king, and we have also more right in David than ye. Why then did ye despise us and our advice? Should not we be first had to bringing back our king? And the words of the men of Judah were what? Fiercer, in the King James Version, than the words of the men of Israel. Who got their way? The one that bullied their way into it. This is a bad example of a conversation and a way to calm anger. A very subtle one, but we can see things like this throughout the Bible and where people are communicating. And this is just one example of this principle applied. They didn't treat each other like regular brothers, did they? They got into an arguing match about who had a greater right to bringing David back, all because of what? Pride? Who had a greater right to do it than the other one did? This is a kingdom that should have been rejoicing together that they brought together the king after a rebellion. They lost common sight of their motive and the common motive that they had, which was restoring the rightful king to the throne. How do we know when to calm? You know, some people are going to say, that's obvious. You know, when this conversation goes the wrong way, I just know. We've got to do something. But oftentimes we miss the turn in a conversation. We miss the fact that somebody has crossed their arms and checked out and leaned back in the chair in a business meeting, or whether they've stopped communicating and coming to services for an extended period of time because of some conversation they had. That turn of the conversation can be very subtle. And it's hard to pick up on at times unless you pay attention to it and follow on it. The first thing is pay attention. How do we know when to calm? We have to pay attention to the conversations and see people's reactions. If we're going to pay attention to something, we made the point Sunday morning, what's one of the problems with the tongue? Talking too much. Sometimes we need to stop and listen. Look for the change in tone, expression, or behavior. That subtle quiver in a person's voice when they're about to get emotional is something to look for sometimes. The change in tone where an individual starts to get, I am mad as I can be. Or my family would say, when my ears turn red, then it's time to change the conversation. Well, those are all tells or all things that we have to look for in conversation to know when a situation has turned and know when it's time to step back and to try to calm the conversation. What do we do to bring calm into a conversation? One of the points that we made in our crucial conversation studies is that we have, in order for dialogue to exist, in order for communication to exist, there has to be safety. Both parties have to feel that they're safe in delivering their ideas and discussing it. If you got a bully that's dominating the conversation, it's not a safe environment. They've already reverted to violence to get their way. So a return to safety by establishing a common purpose and a common motive. We as Christians have a key advantage, should have, to the rest of the world. What is our common motive? Saving of souls. We all want to get to heaven. We should all be concerned about the soul of the individual that's sitting across from us in the conversation that we're having. Change my tone and change the choice of my words as another way to think about bringing calm to the conversation. Proper uses of the tongue are also to disperse knowledge. Dispersing knowledge, we can see from the standpoint of people communicating and delivering gospel through conversation in class environments, through delivering of sermons and of the gospel, but here, dispersing of knowledge. And the book of Proverbs makes the point in Proverbs 15:7, the lips of the wise disperse knowledge. 2 Timothy 2:2, what have you heard from me in the presence of many witnesses? Entrust to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Paul was admonishing Timothy to take what he had been told at the hand of Paul and to apply it and entrust it into other men so that the word could be spread. Ephesians 4 and 29. Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good to building up as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear. These are all ways to apply and disperse knowledge and as a proper use of the tongue. So how? Provoke thought. How did Jesus attempt to communicate with people that were very much against what he had to say? Did he just come out and say, "You're wrong"? No, he turned to them and asked them a question. When they asked him a question, he would turn and ask them a question in return. It's a very effective technique for getting someone to look inside and think about it. So when the Sadducees and Pharisees came to him and asked him trick questions, what did he turn around and do? He might say that you know not what the Bible says or the law says in this matter, and then ask them a question to tell them, essentially bring them to the right conclusion. It's a different way, a non-confrontational way of steering someone to provoke their thought. In a different manner, outside of the context of the scripture. If we are in a conversation with an individual and we know that it is a difficult conversation, one might ask, have you considered it from this perspective? To get them to think about it in a little different way. We made the point on Sunday morning about perspectives. If I stand in that corner and look this way, or I stand in that corner and look this way, I'm either going to see the left side of people's faces or the right side, but unless I look at it from both perspectives, I don't get a full picture of their face. In the case of dialogue, if we only have one opinion that's being espoused, do we have a full understanding of the discussion that's going on? Not normally. Now, in the case of God's word, there is only one right answer. But when it comes to, for example, matters of judgment, it helps to have an understanding of different perspectives so that we can discern wisely and make a good decision. So, proclaim with confidence. Peter and John spoke boldly in Acts 4 and 13. If we're going to disperse knowledge, well, I kind of think it's this way. Does that inspire confidence in the hearer? No. But if I turn around and I say, well, let's look at this. If we look at the scriptures in here, it says this. Not my opinion. It's what the word says. Does that inspire confidence? Takes it off of me and my wisdom and puts it in God's wisdom. Proper use of the tongue is also to rebuke sin. We see this handled in different ways. Proverbs 27 and 6, faithful are the wounds of a friend. Okay, if we have a friend and they see us doing wrong, they are truly our friend if they speak to us about it. If they avoid the conversation, do they really have our soul in best interest? Proverbs 8, 28 and 23. He who rebukes a man will find more favor afterward than he who flatters with the tongue. Okay, well, you know, I'd much rather hear somebody tell me something good than to tell me something bad. But what do I need? I need that rebuke in order to do the right thing. Matthew 16, 21 through 23, Jesus rebuked Peter. And in that particular passage, 16:23-23, and this is not the first time, first or the last time, that Peter will be rebuked by Jesus. But I think it's important to look at a couple of them and see why. In 22-23, and Peter took him and began to rebuke him, talking about rebuking Christ, saying, "Be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee." But he turned and said unto Peter, "Get thee behind me, Satan, thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men." Do we think that that was probably a crucial conversation? Whose soul was at risk there? Peter's. And did Jesus shy away from the message in any way? I think he put it pretty blunt to him, did he not? And this was all because Peter had said, "No, you're not going to die and bear the suffering on the cross." He firmly corrected him. And we made the point in the previous, we need to deliver the message with confidence. Certainly Jesus, in delivering his message here, delivered it straightforward and with confidence, with no question. In John 13:1-9, Jesus rebuked Peter about washing his feet. What does the story there go through and say? What did Jesus start to do for his disciples? As a matter of custom, he went about to wash their feet. And when he got to Peter, what did Peter say? You're not going to wash my feet. And what did Jesus say to him? "If I don't wash your feet, you don't have any part with me." Again, a firm, confident, blunt response. What was Peter's response? "Lord, wash all of me." It took that message in a way. And granted, this is Christ. He certainly had all wisdom to know how to deliver a message. But he gives us examples of ways to deliver a message. He didn't berate Peter up and down. He simply put it, "This is the way it is." And Peter responded to it. In Matthew 14:1-12, John the Baptist spoke out against Herod and his sin regarding Herodias. The whole passage there in verses 1-12 talks about he did it regularly and he did it openly. What was the problem in the case of Herod? He didn't have a right to his brother Philip's wife. And John the Baptist said, "You don't have a right to her," openly and publicly. Herod wanted to kill him for what he had done. Who did he fear? People, because they realized that John was a prophet, and they viewed him as such. Ultimately, because of the things that went on and the promises that were made, Herod did behead John the Baptist. But we see here John didn't shy away from delivering and rebuking the sin that was at hand. Why? It saves the soul from death. James 5:20. "Let him know that whoever brings back a sinner from his wandering will save his soul from death and will cover a multitude of sins." Proper use of the tongue encourages others. Has anyone ever been discouraged? I think we can all raise our hands. We can raise our hands that we could have been discouraged over an event in our lives and the death of a family member, where a kind word has been spoken, that shared in an instance where someone had a remembrance of that family member, and it made us feel good. Proper use of the tongue is to encourage others. If an individual is perpetually discouraged, what's the likelihood they're going to respond favorably to any message regarding the gospel? Not likely. Certainly, if they're discouraged over the behavior of fellow brethren. So Proverbs 15 and 23, a man has joy by the answer of his mouth, and a word spoken in due season, how good it is. A word spoken at the right time carries so much weight, extreme value. Proverbs 15 and 26, the thoughts of the wicked are an abomination to the Lord, but gracious words are pure. In a case like this, encouraging words, would they not be gracious? They would be. Proverbs 16 and 13. Righteous lips are the delight of a king, and he loves him who speaks what is right. We see kings, particularly in the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel, that did not heed the words of the prophets that came to them. Sometimes they did, sometimes they did not. But in the cases where they did, those kings would have certainly valued the words spoken. Can you think of some kings that totally disregarded the words given to them? How about Rehoboam and the council of his advisors? The older men, he disregarded. The younger men, his peers, ate it up. What happened to him? He lost 10/12 of his kingdom. If we look to the counsel that was given to Jeroboam, God said to Jeroboam that I will establish your kingdom if you will what? Serve me. What did he turn around and do? Set up golden calves at Dan and Beersheba. Bethel, sorry. It's the righteous words and adhering to those are key. Proverbs 22 and 11. He who loves purity of heart and whose speech is gracious will have the king as his friend. I have to think of someone that fits into this category. Don't you think Daniel had an interesting relationship with Nebuchadnezzar in delivering counsel to him as one of his key advisors? He who loves the purity of heart and whose speech is gracious will have the king as his friend. When Daniel went to Nebuchadnezzar and said, O king, there is a God that can interpret dreams and can give you this answer. What do you think was in Nebuchadnezzar's mind when he actually came and told him what his dream was? Well, first off, if he's a man, he's going to say, wow, that's a really smart man. He must have something going for him. And we know that Nebuchadnezzar did not fully respect God, Jehovah, until he actually lost his mind and was put out of his kingdom for a period of time. But I have to think that Nebuchadnezzar had a great deal of respect for the wise words that Daniel delivered. And after seeing the behavior and the deliverance of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, I would have to imagine that he also had great respect for their words as well. Proverbs 10 and 11, the mouth of the righteous is a fountain of life, but the mouth of the wicked conceals violence. Fountain of life. Why is it a fountain of life? Mouth of the righteous. If we equate righteousness to willingness to serve God, fear God, will deliver the commandments and behave in a way so as to encourage others to do so. Proverbs 10:21, the lips of the righteous feed many, but fools die for lack of sense. In the case of the our earlier study about foolish behavior and fools, What did the fool do? He didn't sow in the right season. As a result, he had no food. The fool was sluggard, unwilling to actually feed himself. So from a conclusion standpoint on the proper use of the tongue, Proverbs 16, 23 through 4. The heart of the wise makes his speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to his lips. Gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. Gracious words are like a honeycomb. How many in here like honey as a sweetener for their food? It's pretty good. Don't we like it when someone talks to us in a way that makes us feel they care about us? That's graciousness. Even when we're behaving in a way that we don't deserve it. God does that for us all the time. James 3 and 8. But no human being can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil, full of deadly poison. But what can it be done with the tongue? It can be bridled. It can be controlled. It can be steered in a way for good or for evil. But it requires a conscious effort to do so. Thoughts and comments on proper use of the tongue. And it doesn't have to just come from the book of Proverbs. Oh, Nehemiah had to have had a tremendous relationship with the king. And for him to recognize his countenance, and granted, the cupbearer had a very special relationship for the king because the king knew his life depended upon the cupbearer. So I would watch his attitude and see what his behavior was like for certain. But he did. There's no doubt that he had a special relationship with the king. There are numerous Bible characters that we can see that type of relationship. We talked before in our studies on behavior with friends, and the Bible and Proverbs talks about the friendships. There is no doubt in the conversations that David and Jonathan shared that there was graciousness and commonness of goals and purpose in their desire for the kingdom to be growing and be preserved. Proper uses of the tongue in the days of Joseph. The conversation could have gone so badly with his brothers when they came for that final round of food. He could have really stuck it to them. But he revealed himself in a way that showed that he cared for them and that he had fully forgiven them because it was God's providence that it all happened. He revealed to them the purpose that they didn't know. Jacob and Esau didn't have a very good relationship very early on, did they? But toward the end, what do we see them doing together? They come together and they take care of their father and they bury him. And they treat one another with due respect. And through the proper use of the tongue in that particular case, because Jacob was no doubt afraid of Esau left and right. And we see Esau exhibiting proper behavior. We can keep naming examples over and over. Does anyone else have anything else they'd like to add for a discussion on the proper use of the tongue? Some of our other proverbs that we've talked about is making sure that we put our head in, our mind in gear before we put our mouth in gear. Appreciate your thoughts. Appreciate your comments and attendance. Thank you.